I mean, Samuel wrote them and told them, and here's what he said to them. He said, so Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked him of a king, And he said, this will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots and among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and of fifties, and some to do his plowing, to reap his harvests, and take his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. In other words, he's going to do what? Big draft. We don't have a draft in America anymore. But he's going to draft people for war and for building crops for him. He's going to make people do that for himself. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. That sound familiar? He will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you've chosen for yourself, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. So they said what? We don't care. Give us a king. We want a king. Yes, Prologue. The judges were so what? Corrupt. Okay, corrupt. Okay. Some of them were. Some of them were not. In fact, it's interesting. I've always observed, I don't know if you read your Bible through, but if you go through the Old Testament and you're just reading along in the Judges and so forth, the Kings and Chronicles, you notice something that's kind of amazing. The condition of the people is based on the king. In other words, the integrity and the faithfulness and the quality of the leader determines the condition of the people. Is that not a scary idea? It also teaches you in Daniel chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar learned this lesson, that it's God who sets up one and takes down another. So in Israel and the judges, they'd rock along for 20 years and everything would be great and they prospered. And then they'd get an evil judge or an evil king. And what would happen? They would go worship idols again. God would bring judgment on them. And then they would cry out to the Lord, and God would bring a righteous guy. They would have to have a revival every 20, 40, 60 years. I just find that an amazing concept. Because it seems that our government tracks us. Oh, 12, yeah, 12 pieces, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they wiped out Benjamin. Yeah, in the last three chapters of Judges, in fact, it finishes off. They had many problems we have today, by the way. And it says, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes, which kind of sounds reminiscent of us, doesn't it, Doug? Yeah, we've had the It's a short-term memory. There you go, Great Awakening. Thing. We've had two of them, right? We have Great Awakening, and those are more moralistic than really. Than people are changing the way they behave. In fact, they had big problems with drinking and all kinds of adultery and things, and people repented in these Great Awakenings. We haven't had one lately. Now, one of the things Samuel said is they're going to take your men and your women and he's going to enlist them into his service and basically abuse them. The second thing he said is he's going to take what from you? A tenth of your money. Most of you would probably die for a 10% tax rate. Right? Do you know when the first income tax was instituted in the United States of America? It's going to surprise you. was long before World War II. It was long before World War I. A- 1862, Abraham Lincoln. And the Supreme Court, they repealed the bill in 1872 after the Civil War because it was what? Unconstitutional. Here's the tax rates. 3% on incomes between $600 and $10,000. 5% on higher incomes. There wasn't any Social Security, by the way. And today, Social Security is 7.65, doubled, because the employer pays that too. So you're really up to 13% just for that aspect. Yes? Why don't they use that precedent that it's unconstitutional? The Supreme Court repeatedly ruled it was unconstitutional. All right. So what do you have to do to make it where it's not unconstitutional? We had to make it what? Constitutional. How do we do that? Well, let me finish here. They raised the ultimately 10% on everything above 10,000, which would be, by the way, about 150,000, probably about 250,000 today. If you made 10,000 back in 1862, or it would be like a quarter of a million today. All right, so those are rich people. So what did they do? They created the 16th Amendment in 1913. That's where you got your modern income tax. The reason they had to have a constitutional amendment was to make it what? Constitutional, because the Supreme Court said what? It ain't. It's the only way they could get around the Constitution. This was a warning. I want you to listen closely from a guy named Richard Byrd. Now, that's not the same Byrd they used to have in Congress. He's not that old. But in fact, his name was Robert, if I remember right. Probably related to him. I think he was from West Virginia, if I remember right, right? Here's what he said when they were going to create, this is 1913. Under the president was Woodrow Wilson, a progressive Democrat. A hand from Washington will be stretched out and placed upon every man's business. The eye of the federal inspector will be every man's counting house. The law will of necessity have inquisitorial powers, investigative powers. It will provide penalties. It will create complicated machinery. Under it, men will be hailed into courts distanced from their homes. Now, you may not know this, but I happen to know this, that is right on target. That's exactly what it did, all right? Now, heavy fines imposed by distant and unfamiliar tribunals will constantly menace the taxpayer. An army of federal inspectors, quote, IRS agents, spies and detectives will descend upon the state. Who of us will have the knowledge, who have had the knowledge by the doings of the federal officials in the Internal Revenue Service, can be blind to what will follow? That was his warning. He was right. Our Congress enacted an income tax in October 1913, 1% on incomes over $3,000, $4,000 if you were married. I could live with that. But government's never satisfied, right? With a 6% surtax on incomes above $500,000. By 1918, the top rate of income tax has increased to 77% because of World War I. On income over $1 million, which today would be $15.3 million. In 2012 dollars. To finance World War I, the average rate for the rich, however, was only 15%. The top marginal tax rate was increased to 63% during the Great Depression. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? And steadily increased, reaching 94% on all dollars, all income over $200,000. And steadily increased, which was equivalent to $2.5 million in 2012 in 1945. During World War II, Congress introduced payroll withholding and quarterly tax payments, because by doing that, by the way, they could minimize the anger of paying them. Because if you had to write one check at the end of the year, most of you would be really angry. Some are ye angry now, all right? All right, 1% on incomes over $3,000 initially. Then Franklin Roosevelt raised it to 94%, the Great Society. John F. Kennedy argued, a Democrat, to reduce the top bracket to 70% in the 60s to help the economy. That's where it was when I started. I started in accounting in taxes in 1970. The top rate was 70%. I never remember telling a guy what he owed. He made over $350, which is what you had to make. I never remember telling him how many hundreds of thousands he had to write a check for. It was the last time I did his return. Ronald Reagan reduced and argued that the top rate ought to be 50%. That was in the early 80s. And then in 1986, with the Tax Act that changed everything, they raised the top rate to 28%, or lowered it to 28%. Bill Clinton came along and raised it back to 39.6. Let me tell you something. I used to do more taxes than I do today, but in 86, I said the secret is this. When you take away a lot of things, which they did, took away a lot of deductions, when they take away a lot of deductions, all they have to do is raise the rate to get more revenue, but the deductions are gone. Now, I'm not a biblical prophet because I was off 0.4%. I said in 1986, by 1990s, the top tax rate will be 40%. And it was. Right? Ronald Reagan reduced it. And then we have George Bush reduced it to 35% and the capital gains to 15%. And then Barack Obama raised to 39.6% and 20% on capital gains. And he added two more taxes for Medicare. And one of them is called the net investment income tax. If you make over $200,000, it's 3.8%. And it's 0.9% if you make over $200,000. That's kind of the summary of our tax rate. Our taxes are somewhat high. What about complexity? Now, this chart is hard to read, and I knew that before I put it up, but we're talking about oppression. This is 1945. This little bitty red line right here as to the number of words in the code. This is 2010. That number is in the thousands. That number right there is, no, it's not 80,000. No, it's not that either. I forgot what the deal is. I'm going to tell you, it's pages, not words. Here's the words. Originally, the code was 11,400 words in 1914. 1 year after, it was amended. By 1955, it was 409,000 words, an annual growth of 9.1%. It grew from 409,000 words to 3.8 million words between 1955 and 2010. The rate was 4.1%. The actual number of words in the Internal Revenue Code or the number of pages in the words in the Internal Revenue Code and the regulations are over 9 million. Does that create a problem? What problem does it create? No one can understand the Revenue Code, even me. Yes, Sandy. And that fits right under Solomon's oppression deal because the complexity, I have said that, by the way, every time they make a new law, the government never gives up revenue and it never gives up power. And it always increases penalties. And some of the penalties, for example, let me give you a quick one. This one really sets me off. I will. This doesn't sound like a Bible lesson, but there's a point. I was sitting in a seminar down in Galveston, and a guy was speaking who I know well. I go to hear him all the time, who's an expert in taxes. How many of you have ever been reimbursed for your insurance by your company? You pay the company, you pay the insurance, and you get reimbursed. Anybody in here? Rich? Gary? Anybody else? The government has decided, the IRS is not in the law, nowhere in the law, but they've decided since that reimbursement is not unlimited coverage, that if a company does that for more than one person, more than one would be what? Two. a smart class, I'm telling you. The penalty for doing that, that they would assess against you, would be $100 per day or $36,500 per year. I have that circumstance in my firm. And the goal of the law was what? To get everybody covered? So here they're telling us we can no longer provide one of our people coverage because of the way it works. It's egregious. It's oppressive. Now, there was this case in the conflict in the tax court. Tax court is made up of people who used to be with the IRS, so you can tell what kind of decisions you're going to get there. This was a lawyer, and I'm going to skip it out. It was Alvin Bobro account. He was a tax lawyer. And he had three IRAs account, two in his name, one in his wife. And there was a provision in the code that you could take money out of your IRA and put it back in 60 days, and it would be tax-free. So he did it three times in 1 year. And he relied on the government's ruling, the IRS's publication on it, that said you could do it, and prior court rulings and said you would do it. But all of a sudden, they changed their mind, and they said you can't do it. You can only do it once a year. So what did they do? They taxed him $60,000 and a $10,000 penalty, and the court said in its ruling, you should not rely on what the IRS tells you. Is that oppression? Sure it is. When you don't know what the rules really are, you can't rely on the government's rules. Here's another one. Andrew Clyde. This one will really catch your attention. Andrew Clyde, a Navy veteran who served in Iraq, started his small firearm store in Athens, Georgia in the 90s, and over the years he watched his business grow. And on April 12, 2013, two agents swooped in and seized $1 million from his company bank account. How can you do that? Sandy knows you've been structuring. You've read about it. All right. So what is structuring? Well, because of the drug issues in our country, the government has passed laws starting back in the 70s that basically says if they think you've been structuring your transactions, which are defined as this, you are putting currency in your bank account and it looks like you're doing a series of transactions under $9,000. Like, let's say you had 4 days in a row where you put $9,800 in your bank. They call that structuring. For each time you do it, if it is structuring, the penalty is 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. All right? And so this guy was putting currency into his bank account. He owns a firearm store. All right? So they went into his bank account. The bank alerted him that this was happening, and they just took his money. The soft-spoken small businessman joined others in recalling their ordeals to the House. They went before to testify in the House. And then Koskinen, who is our current commissioner, who apologized to those snared by the IRS practice, assured that the agency stopped seizing assets without clear wrongdoing in October. That's nice. But the law that allowed Clyde and others to be targeted is still on the books. I did not serve three combat tours in Iraq, only to come home and be extorted by the government. Clyde testified he urged Congress to change the law. In a recent statement, Koskinen defended current IRS practices. The IRS pursue seizures only when there is a probable cause that the money is subject to forfeiture. A probable cause. And only after seizure affidavits have been reviewed by a federal prosecutor and authorized by a federal judge, he said. The Institute for Justice says that they are demanding reform. One-third of the cases they examined, they had no evidence of criminal activity. Just an allegation. Took an average of 1 year to get your money back. Only half of it you got back. And the rest of it showed that the median amount seized was $34,000. So what are they doing? They're stealing your money. That's corruption. Without evidence. Why was the guy who was a Navy SEAL who served in Iraq, why was he doing it? Because he had an insurance policy that said he could not keep more than $10,000 of cash on hand, and he wouldn't want evidence of putting more than $10,000 in the bank at any one time, so he would hold on to it until it got up to $10,000, then he would put it in the bank. Solomon said what? Yeah, can't trust me. You can't trust my officials. They oppress the poor. And this has happened thousands of times, by the way, in our government. It's not the only issue. All right? Moses said this, Solomon left the temple and went to the city hall where he again witnessed corrupt politicians oppressing the poor. The government officials violated the law by using their authority to help themselves and not to serve others, a practice condemned by Moses. We had a huge uprising, uproar back in the 70s or the 80s when the government basically let out that their ability to show that they were a good revenue agent was based on the amount of taxes they collected on an audit. So what do you think they did? They would raise positions where they would assert a taxes, hoping the taxpayers would give up. All right? Moses said this, you shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. And in Deuteronomy, he says, you shall not pervert the justice to an alien or an orphan. Now take a widow's garment and pledge, but you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. Verse 9 says this. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. This is a very difficult scripture. We're not exactly sure what it means. In the Living Bible, it says, over them all is a king, and over a king who is devoted to his country, only he can bring order from this chaos. That's pretty close to what the interpretations I read. In other words, even though you have corruption in your system, it is beneficial to have government. Did you hear me? Even though you have corruption in the system, even though that upsets you terribly, it is good that you have order in your society. Because otherwise, what do you have? Chaos and anarchy. Sort of like Ferguson, Missouri, or whatever, where things just get totally out of control. Yes? Oh, that's Moses' father. Yeah, no. Yeah. No, Jethro, exactly right. He was a Midianite. He was his father-in-law, and he said to Moses, Moses did this. Every day he would go out. This is a great principle if you're in business, by the way, or in any organization. Moses would go out every day and beat his brains out, and they would have 100,000 Jewish people lined up to get a hearing because he thought what? I am the only one qualified to make a ruling. And Jethro came to him and went with him out to watch him work one day. And basically, I'm going to paraphrase the scripture. Moses, you're nuts. That's right. Crazy. He said, you are not only wearing yourself out, you're wearing the people out. And so he said, raise up those who are qualified. Let them hear the smaller cases, and you rule on the greater cases. That's what that's talking about. What Solomon is talking about is what? Within the government, corruption. He's talking about the fact that it's corrupt, but then he comes back around and says, apparently he is saying, even the king milks the land for his own profit, which is what, forgot what, that's the Holy Bible, New Living Translation. This is what Wiersbe says. I think he's on point. Verse 9 is difficult, and major translations do not agree, as we just looked at. The general idea seems to be that in the area, in spite of corruption in the bureaucracy, it is better to have organized government and a king over the land than to have anarchy. And I think that's true. A few dishonest people may profit from corrupt practices, but everybody benefits from organized authority. Of course, the ideal is to have government that is what? Both honest and efficient. But man's heart being what it is, the temptation to dishonest gain is always there. I'm thinking of Charlie Rangel. And a few, Lois Lerner. Costigan, the IRS commissioner. These are people who don't tell the truth, or like Rangel owes $4.5 million in taxes, and yet he still wins elections. Here's what Lord Acton wrote to Bishop Mandel Creighton in 1887. Power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. I bet you didn't know who said that, but I bet you've heard it. Yes, Doug. Okay. Yeah, where they don't have a good government. Well, in fact, in America, you know, Doug, that's a great point that you raised, because America is based on Judeo-Christian principles. And our laws were written consistent with those principles. And for years, the distinguishing factor of America, and one of the reasons why many believe it was so prosperous, is because it obeyed the laws of the government. For example, if you go to some countries south of us, you cannot do business without paying mordida, which is a bribe, right? And yet those countries and their economic situations are destitute. And when you go to other countries, if you were to go, for instance, AB, where's AB? He's here. Nigeria. Any issues in Nigeria? Huh? You got an email lately telling you you won so much money, right? Countries that you bill them for that, right? Don't answer them if they said you would. But here's the point. When you have an honest and efficient government, then, where the populace operates on biblical principles, you have a much better chance of a prosperous result. Does that make sense? In other words, bribery corrupts an entire system, which is, by the way, some of what Solomon is talking about. He said a lot about bribery and corruption in the Proverbs. And Doug's point is well taken. If you go somewhere where that's evident, it's so much harder to do business. Now, I've said all that, which it says to you, from a biblical perspective, in my opinion, Solomon is exactly on point as to government and its corruption. Now, what's your attitude? And where should you see things? Because let me tell you, there are millions of taxpayers who are angry at, for instance, the IRS, and therefore either cheat big time or don't file. I have actually represented several of them. I remember airplane pilots. Tim, they have a lot of time on their hands. They create their own churches. Have you ever heard of those guys? Tim's a retired pilot. I represented one of them. Now, they do come to the Lord at the time that they get caught. And they take positions like, I'm angry at the government for what they're doing, you know, abortion and all of this, and the Supreme Court, and that's a justification for them for what they do. And the question is that a proper attitude? Solomon's told you that there is corruption in the system, and we know that's true. He says the king still benefits from the land, and he's better than having no government. So what should your attitude be? What was the attitude of Jesus? Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? What did the Pharisees want him to say? No. No, we give it to the temple, not to Caesar. But he detected trickery and said to them, show me a denarius, one day's wage. Whose likeness and inscription does it have? And they said, Caesar's. And he said to them, then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are to God. So Jesus' attitude was that we pay our taxes and we respond to the authority of our government. In Matthew 17, he has a distinct advantage over you. Now, Jim has never had this experience. But Peter came to him and said, when he came to the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, what do you think, Simon? From who do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons or for strangers? And he said, from strangers, Peter did. And he said, Jesus said to them, the sons are exempt. However, so that we do not offend them, go to the sea, throw in a hook, and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you'll find a shekel. Take that, give it to them for you and me. Jesus paid his taxes. Only you hadn't caught a fish that had a shekel in its mouth. But he's showing you what? You obey the law. This is actually a temple tax that they had to pay every year. And then finally, this is the one that bugs a lot of Christians. Romans 13. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities. Is that a smart thing? Absolutely. For there is no authority except from God. So what does that tell you? Your government was established by God, corrupted by man. And those who are established by God, and therefore whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God. And they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. All right? And then he says this. Sorry for the small print. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. By the way, that's your capital punishment verse. All right? For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, to tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom is due, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. So here is your lesson. The system can stink. But your obligation for your own peace of mind, for your own comfort of existence, is that you follow what the government orders and you pay your taxes. Now let me throw in something extra. It is God who's in charge of your money. Do you think it honors him more when you follow the law and submit your proper tax, or when you cheat like crazy on your taxes and shortchange him? Follow the law. My view is this. When you obey the law, God has the opportunity to make up what you need in order to pay your taxes. Chuck? His question was, what is my view on the American Revolutionary War? Why would he ask that? I know. Huh? We were rebelling against taxes, were we not? Let me ask you a question. Can God use the sin of man to bring about his result? That's the answer. It would be a sin to rebel, but at the same time, God can use that for his own. And you individually are probably an example of that. Doug? You're going to take your baby. Right. So what do? The answer is what Peter says. It is better to obey God than man. In other words, there comes a point when the government, for example, the government was to say you couldn't have a Bible or you couldn't pray and so forth. And we're going to reach that point, people, pretty soon with our latest Supreme Court rulings, where you're going to have to determine whether you're going to do what God has said versus what man has said. So there is a limit to obedience. I think that's valid. Yeah, I think the Scripture teaches that. Yeah. So look, if you put your faith in Jesus Christ, if you say he died for you and you're putting your trust in him, this is your admonition. And I'm trying to give you an overview of what Solomon observed about the government, which is true, is it not? But it's not our attitude. It can upset you, but it's not what you're supposed to do. I hope I'm not confusing you. Are you with me on that? Next week, we're going to look at the verse that says, he who loves gold never has enough. Who is satisfied with his income will never be satisfied with the abundance. Have a great week.